lot of interviews and discussions about all sorts of things and put them in a coherent and, I think, pretty effective form, including formulating 10 principles. That's their contribution, and including material that discusses them. And you can look at the film and see, or the book, but my feeling is they did a really good job.
So the book is accompanying this film that is now out on Netflix. But you talk about, for example, principle one, reducing democracy, principle two, shaping ideology, and principle three, redesigning the economy.
Well, all of those fall together, and they're part of a pretty remarkable development that's taking place in human history. Humans in the last 60 or 70 years have succeeded in creating a kind of a perfect storm, literally. There's a kind of a pincers movement that we've created. Two major attacks on the prospects for survival: global warming, nuclear weapons, the Anthropocene, the nuclear age. And the third is a set of socioeconomic policies designed to undermine the possibility of dealing with the problems. The problems could be dealt with only in a functioning democracy of engaged, informed people who could make decisions, who would be informed and could make decisions to deal with the crises. But the so-called neoliberal programs of the past generation, sort of somewhat market-oriented programs designed to undermine the institutions, the governmental and popular institutions that might deal with these issues, all a unit. One result is a very significant decline in democracy. You can see it in which is almost built into the policies. It's perfectly built. You can't carry out economic policies of the type that have been that have been implemented in the past generation in a functioning democracy. That's impossible. Let me just take a look at the numbers. The neoliberal programs were basically taking off right around 1980, escalated, started a little with the late Carter, escalated under Reagan, went on more under Clinton, and so on. 2007 was the peak of supposed success. This is right before the crash. A lot of euphoria among economists, political analysts about the great achievements of neoclassical economics, of the great moderation, the neoliberal programs, dismantling of regulations, all these great successes. 2007, what was happening to American working people at that time? In 2007, wages, real wages, were lower than they had been in 1979 when the experiment took off. In fact, for the majority of the population, it's a period of stagnation or decline. Benefits have declined. People had been, some of the reasons were explained by Alan Greenspan, head of the Federal Reserve, who was in charge pretty much of managing the economy. He testified to Congress that part of the success of the economy, the low inflation and so on, was due to what he called growing worker insecurity. Working people were insecure. They were intimidated. They knew that they were in a dangerous situation, precarious situation. As a result, they didn't press for increase in wages and for decent wages and benefits. They were willing to accept, in fact, effective decline in their living standards. And Greenspan, who was a close observer of the economy, pointed out that this continued even when jobs were increasing in the late Clinton period. It was deeply embedded in the nature of the policies being carried out. that working people are intimidated. They're living precarious lives. Many of them are part-time. They're losing security. Their unions are being destroyed. And their wages are declining. So it's all great. The economy is wonderfully healthy. Can you carry out policies like that in a democracy? I mean, are people going to vote for it? Same in Europe, even worse in many ways.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to be a founding sponsor of the Waterfront Blues Festival. This year, the festival will be held June 30th through July 4th at Tom McCall Waterfront Park. Festival passes are on sale now, including the Blues Buddy Pass and the basic 5-day pass at early bird prices. More information about the passes, the festival, and more can be found at kboo.fm/WBF2017.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of World Environment Day Global Goals Fair on Saturday, June 3rd, from noon to 4 at the Hawthorne Hostel in Portland. The Global Goals Fair aims to increase community awareness of Agenda 2030, their sustainable development goals, and local efforts to achieve them. There will also be food, drink, raffles, and entertainment. Again, that's World Environment Day Global Goals Fair on Saturday, June 3rd from noon to 4 at the Hawthorne Hostel, 3031 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tamales and cha-cha.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 8:06 on More Talk Radio. Is taking the day off, so we're going to present a Memorial Day special. Veterans for Peace Radio remembers China Grove and the letters to the wall.
Welcome to the Veterans for Peace Radio Hour. And remembering Memorial Day, here's Catherine Taylor.
Shall me.
That's Kathy Mattea with Vacant Chair. All right, my name is Jim Wolgemuth, and with co-host and fellow Vietnam veteran Harvey Bennett, who is on the mend, but Harvey will make his presence heard today. We're members of Veterans for Peace, which is a global organization of military veterans and allies whose collective efforts are to build a culture of peace by using our experiences, lifting our voices. Our network is comprised of over 100 chapters worldwide. All right. So here we are, Memorial Day, and despite the continual distractions of the Trump administration, we need to take some time to reflect. I used to visit the wall, the Vietnam Memorial, in Washington, D.C. regularly because I used to live and work in Washington, D.C. In fact, I worked right across Constitution Avenue from the wall. I would often visit, but I made sure I was always there for Veterans Day and for Memorial Day. It was always sad and moving. We then moved to North Carolina, and that's where the rest of the story comes in.
Now, when we moved to North Carolina, my visits to the wall stopped. But I took a picture of the wall with me, and I hung it in my classroom when I was teaching sixth grade. And out of character, I suppose, come Memorial Day, I would start talking to the kids about Memorial Day. And I would say, okay, what is Memorial Day? And one or two would actually tell me the reason for Memorial Day, the actual reason. But for the most part, the big thing about Memorial Day was the pool was opening. There was also a large group of kids who would mention, well, we got soccer games and baseball games and softball games. And of course, Dad's gonna grill. This is the first official day that Dad can grill out. So it was a special day and the kids would have off. Generally speaking, in those days, the kids were done with their testing, so it was a good day to celebrate. And so I'd ask the kids if they'd ever walked up and down the main street of our little town where I taught school and where they went to school. That was a town called China Grove, North Carolina. And of course, they said yes. Of course, everybody's been up and down Main Street. It was a small little town and tucked in between a couple of banks. There was a little park with some benches and a gazebo and a brick wall. And I would say, have you ever stopped at that brick wall? Not really, my sixth graders would say. Now, there's nothing extraordinary about that little wall in China Grove. There are little walls in lots of communities. And for the most part, they go unnoticed, except for the family member, the odd family member, or maybe an old girlfriend who might have known the name on that wall. Well, one day coming up on Memorial Day lesson, I wanted to make sure I figured out what to discuss with the kids. I stopped at that wall and I saw three names. And I got online to research those three names. And I came across a website that I'll recommend. It's called virtualwall.org. Virtualwall, one word, .org. And I started to look through that and I thought, here's the lesson. Here's the lesson. So I took the virtual wall to my classroom because we had a whiteboard and we could easily put the internet actually right up on the board and we could manipulate it. Now I had a social studies class and in sixth grade, and at that time before Common Core, we did history of Europe and Central America and South America. So I could easily discuss Vietnam as part of the Cold War with Russia and the wars of the 20th century. So the students were familiar with the numbers of dead in all those wars of the 20th centuries, including the 58,000 killed in Vietnam. But what does that 58,000 look like? So I would ask a student to go up to the whiteboard and using the virtual wall and click on North Carolina, their state, where they were living, where they were going to grow up. And just go scroll down and see what North Carolina's contribution, or how many dead were from North Carolina. So the student would scroll down and scroll and scroll and scroll. And it would be listed by cities, and you would stop at the bigger cities. The kids would stop at the bigger cities. Okay, there's Charlotte, and there's Durham and Fayetteville and Gastonia and Greensboro. And on down and on down. And the kids kept scrolling, and the names kept coming. And this is a sixth grade class. And by this point, the kids are getting really quiet because the names just keep coming. And we would get to the bottom, and I would say, okay, that was just North Carolina. And they go, oh no, that was just North Carolina. So how many do you think, how many names do you think you would see there? And the hands would go up, 15,000, 20,000, 5,000. I'd say, nope. All those names were only 1,613. And they would say, all of those names, 1,613. And I said, consider that. That is just a little bit more than 50 times more young people that were killed in Vietnam. So I asked them, well, what about China Grove? What about China Grove? And they said, of course, well, China Grove's not going to be on there because it's a little town. We've only got 2,000 people, only 2 square miles. But the student would scroll back up, and there's China Grove. And there were two names on that virtual wall. Two of the three names that were on the memorial in Main Street. And these were the two names of the two kids who came from China Grove who were killed in Vietnam. A Ricky Louder and a Ricky Probst, or a Richard Probst. So in essence, we have two Rickies. So I explained that these two names of people had gone to their school. We were in a school that was built by the WPA in the 1930s, so we knew for sure that these two Rickies had gone to this school. And who knows, they'd likely spent time in the classroom where my kids were sitting. So I explained, maybe we discussed, maybe somebody just said, well, they were just like us. And so we brainstormed for just a minute or two about what kids do. What do kids do? How do they spend their time in school and out of school? And we went through sports and arts and music, and we shared what they wanted to do. And then we'd ask the question, do you think the Rickies wanted to do that too? Bless you, Harvey. So on the virtual wall, you can click on the names and you can see a little profile about the people, the casualties. And so I asked the student who had the stylus and who was running the whiteboard, click on Ricky Louder, and up came his medals and his rank, and click again, and it came to his personal military data. Home of record, China Grove, North Carolina. Date of birth, Friday, February 16th, 1951. Service, Marine Corps, regular. Grade at loss, E2. Rank, Private First Class. What was he? Well, he was a rifleman. Length of service, less than 1 year. What was his unit? H Company, 2nd Battalion, 5th Marines, 1st Marine Division. Then it switched to the category casualty data. He started his tour. Ricky started his tour on Wednesday, February 4th, 1970. He was killed, casualty date, March 3rd, 1970. Age at loss, 19. Body recovered. What happened? Hostile, died outright. Other explosive device, ground casualty. So I would explain to kids, he probably stepped on a mine. On the wall in Washington, as Iris has mentioned, he would be panel 13W, line 078. So we would talk about this Ricky. He was younger than the other Ricky, but apparently they were friends. And as I understand it, that he was encouraged to join his buddy Ricky Probst. And I'm calling Ricky Probst. His name was Richard Probst, but I'm calling him Ricky because the parallels of these two boys was staggering. So after seeing the information and seeing that he was in the Marines less than a year and in Vietnam less than a month, you can imagine my classroom. Not sixth grade, but sixth graders have huge hearts and huge empathy. And the whole class, and this was repeated four times during the day because I had 100 students and about 25 kids per class. The whole classroom was deathly quiet because they could see a tear forming in my eye and I could see a tear forming in some of theirs. So there was Ricky Lauder. So I asked the student who was running the board, whether it was a boy or a girl, I said, okay, let's go back and let's click on Ricky Probst. And we clicked. And to their shock, there was a picture. Every once in a while on this wall, on this virtualwall.org, the website, it'll include a picture. And that really kind of grabs you because all of a sudden the picture, you're looking at them in their eyes. It looked like a high school picture. Ricky was in a suit and a tie, and he looked very well kept. And invariably, one of the girls in the class, in every class, would say, oh, he was so cute, or he was so good looking. And so we clicked again to find his profile. And instead of coaching the kids, instead of reading it and pointing through the data, I would say, okay, let's go through this silently. Just everybody just silently look through the data. And I'd watch the kids as they read through home of record, China Grove, date of birth, 3/16/1950. U.S. Marine Corps, E-2, private first class, rifleman, 1st Platoon, H Company, 2nd Battalion, 5th Marines, 1st Marine Division, 3rd MAF. Start of tour, 2/12/1970. Incident date, meaning the date he was killed, 3/16/1970. Age at loss, 20. Body recovered, casualty type, hostile, died outright, ground casualty, other explosive device. He stepped on a mine. You would see that the kids were seeing that, like the other Ricky, he had not served long in Vietnam. In fact, just a little over a month, while Ricky Lauder had served just a little under a month. Then somebody would gasp, normally a girl, who would say out loud, died on his birthday. He died on his birthday. And that's when the whole, whatever little noise or ruffling or whatever in the classroom, that would stop. I always wondered, stepping out of the classroom for a little bit, I always wondered how a mom could cope with that. Now, I never got the chance to talk to their parents, the Ricky's parents. Never followed up. Maybe I should have. But I always wondered how a mom could cope with that. To have her son go off to war and to be killed on the day she gave birth to him. From a day of celebration to a day of, do I say, never-ending sorrow, continual mourning. How do you characterize that? Because you can't remember one without the other. All I know is I felt so bad for his parents, for their parents, for both of their parents, but for Ricky Probst's parents, knowing that their son died on his birthday. So I would show the kids the picture that I brought with me of the wall in Washington, D.C., the wall from Vietnam. It was just a small picture, an 8x11. And it shows portions of a panel with names on it etched into the black granite. And in the background, reflecting off the black granite, was an American flag. So I passed that around the classroom. And the kids would treat it, would pause and treat it really with sympathy, with respect. So I've looked at that picture. I've got it now hanging up in my office at home. I've looked at that picture over and over, and I see that flag reflecting off the black granite among the names that are etched. And I wonder, why did the photographer include the flag? Why did he or she include the flag in that picture, in that photograph? And I was thinking initially, and you'd probably think at first blush, well, it's patriotic. And I was thinking, wait a second, was that flag that put these kids into harm's way to the point where they ended up with being only names on a wall and memories at the base of the wall? So was that flag patriotic? Or was the photographer placing blame? That flag and the government it represented got these 58,000 kids killed, not to mention the millions of Vietnamese who also died. Some could say needlessly. So that was my experience in China Grove. When I was teaching sixth grade there, and we did this year after year for the 5 years that I was teaching social studies. And so to prepare for Memorial Day, because this is, for me, and Harvey's gonna mention a little bit of this in a minute or two too, that, you know, we have these holidays that we kind of give lip service to, and it just bothers me.
I miss China Grove. And I miss my kids. And I miss my friends. And I hope the little memorial in China Grove, I understand it's been moved off of Main Street. I hope it's visited. And I hope the people take the time to wonder and remember. I hope maybe a classmate of the Rickies stops with his or her grandchildren and tries to explain to their kids and remembers how important, and that these people living remember how important their grandchildren are, and also remember the grandchildren that never were. Now, there's a third name on the wall. There's a third name on the little memorial, and that young man was not from China Grove. He was a neighboring community, but he's every bit as important. So I hope the folks of China Grove get a chance throughout the festivities to take a moment. All right. Harvey has a poem.
It's called Orion Rising. It's by Doug Rawlings, one of the co-founders of Veterans for Peace. And this particular poem is called The Wall.
Is it by Doug? Or?
Yeah, it's by Doug. And it's dedicated to Jerry Genizio, who was a founder of Veterans for Peace. And Doug Rawlings is a Vietnam veteran. He's in the artillery. Descending into this declivity, dug into our nation's capital by the cloven hoof of yet another one of our country's tropical wars, slipping past the names of those whose wounds refuse to heal, slipping past the panel where my name would have been, could have been, perhaps should have been, down to the wall's greatest depth where the beginning meets the end, I kneel, staring through my own reflection beyond the names of those who died so young, knowing now that the wall has finally found me, 58,000 yard stares have fixed on me, as if I were their pole star, as if I could guide their mute testimony back into the world, as if I could connect all those dots in the nighttime sky, as if I could tell them the reason why.
That's pretty powerful. And once again, we come up with the question, as people look on this Memorial Day at all those names, why in the world are they there? Why Yes. should they have been there?
Well, I think we forget the purpose of Memorial Day. It's turned into just another patriotic celebration, or just a day to have a picnic. But I read something about all the controversy over the removal of these statues of Confederate leaders in Charlottesville and in New Orleans.
Yeah.
And in there, it made a distinction between a monument and a memorial.
Oh, good.
And a monument is something that is pridefully made.
Mm-hmm.
And it proclaims itself to those who see it. A memorial is the opposite of a monument. It is a plea not to forget.
And that's the difference between the wall, the Vietnam Wall, versus a bronze statue of Robert E. Lee or
Jefferson Davis,
or in Nashville, Nathan Bedford Forrest,
right.
Sitting in the Capitol.
Right.
So
it's a memorial is about memory. That without memory, we're doomed.
Without memory, we're doomed. And here, once again, we're gonna. I guess some officials or some people will actually seriously take time to remember when they go visit the wall, or when they visit other monuments, memorials around the country, mm-hmm. on Memorial Day, or maybe place a flag on a grave, that they take time to remember
But you know, to me, memory without action is driving me crazy.
Yes.
To just bring it down to the simplistic. It's great that some few, remember, but we need to get these people to take action, to call their senators and congressmen, to call the White House. Well, that's right, that line is no longer working, or maybe it is, I don't know. And say, no more war. No more war.
Right. Well, like you said, once you have that memory and it stays with you, you know, it owns you.
It owns you.
And how many veterans live with that the rest of their lives?
Yeah, the ownership.
Memories of their own participation. And their names aren't on the memorials. They're still alive, but their lives are really forever.
Always touched.
Bound up in that, in what they were involved with. So for people who weren't in the war, who aren't veterans, you know, what you often hear is paying their respects. They come to the memorial to pay their respects. And I think what the Veterans for Peace has been able to do with this idea is so important, because they have given people a way to take that and take an action that pays respects by writing a letter to
the wall.
To the wall. To a name on there that means a lot to them, or even just to all those people.
To all of those folks.
All of those people who all were beloved, who all left people behind, you know, whose lives have been changed, you know, irredeemably by the loss of that person.
Yeah, we're going to hear a couple of those letters later in the show.
Yeah. But, you know, in terms of the old saw that we hear every year, we owe them a debt that we can never repay, these war dead. Well, that's true, we can never repay the debt, but if they could speak, does anyone really think that they would want more people to join them?
Exactly.
More names on that wall.
You know, that might be the debt to be repaid, no more war.
Yeah.
You know,
no more names, no more walls. Yeah.
Yeah. No more names, no more walls, no more memorials, no more grave sites. Get it over with. That would be how to repay the debt for all the dead that have come before. And continue to mount up.
Yeah, now the word is they're gonna have another surge in Afghanistan. You know, we've reached a stalemate. We have to do something. And, you know, 16 years of something that doesn't work is just, let's just go for 17.
Yeah. And let's see.
How many more people can we kill?
That's right.
Or have killed.
And that's the thing. Not only is it our war dead, but we still have to remember the other side's war dead, because we kill more people in the name of whatever, in the name of the flag, in the name of the country. We kill more people than any other all other terrorist groups combined.
Of course.
We're considered the terrorist in the world.
Now, Harvey talked about Letters to the Wall, and that is a project coordinated by Doug Rawlings, of Veterans for Peace, who's also coordinating the Full Disclosure Program. The Department of Defense is actually commemorating the 50th anniversary of Vietnam, and there's a website, and Veterans for Peace just wants to make sure that there is full disclosure. There is no whitewashing. Well, Doug is the one who coordinated that letter writing to the wall, and he's put together a book that we mentioned. So we want to read a couple of those letters to the wall. And if you want a copy of this book called Letters to the Wall,
And they are a great asset to any middle school library. Hint. Go to Lulu, LULU.com, and order one or more. So, Harvey now is going to read a letter from a Peggy Akers who grew up in America.
Dear America, remember me? I was the girl next door. Remember when I was 13, America, and rode on top of the fire engine in the Memorial Day parade? I'd won an essay contest on what it meant to be a proud American. And it was always me, America, the cheerleader, the Girl Scout, who marched in front of the high school band, carrying our flag, the tallest, the proudest. And remember, America, you gave me the Daughters of the American Revolution Good Citizen Award for patriotism, and I was only 16. And then you sent me to war, America, along with thousands of other men and women who loved you. It's Memorial Day, America. Do you hear the flags snapping in the wind? There's a big sale at Macy's, and there's a big parade in Washington for the veterans. But it's not the American flag or the sound of drums I hear. I hear a helicopter coming in. I smell the burning of human flesh. It's Thomas, America, the young black kid from Atlanta, my patient, burned by an exploding gas tank. I remember how his courage kept him alive that day, America, and I clung to his only finger and whispered over and over again how proud you were of him, America, and he died. And Pham, he was only 8, America, and you sprayed him with napalm, and his skin fell off in my hands, and he screamed as I tried to comfort him. And America, what did you do with Robbie, the young kid I sat next to on the plane to Vietnam? His friends told me a piece of shrapnel ripped through his young heart. He was only 17. It was his first time away from home. What did you tell his mother and father, America? Hold us, America. Hold all your children, America. Alan will never hold anyone again. He left both his arms and legs back there. He left them for you, America. America, you never told me that I'd have to put so many of your sons, the boys next door, in body bags. You never told me. This is Peggy Akers, who served as a nurse in Vietnam.
When will we ever learn? Well, let's continue with another letter, and this is another lady who had friends who went to Vietnam. Her name is Marion Malcolm. Here's part of a letter from Marion Malcolm about her friend Ron Phillips. He used his years of life and the pain of his experiences in Vietnam to reach young people, to tell them that service in the military is not the grand adventure portrayed by military recruiters. It wasn't easy talking to students. Required Ron to remember the pain he buried while he was in Vietnam. Once he told me about retrieving the weapon and going through the belongings of a dead Vietnamese soldier. He may have been the one who killed the man. He wasn't sure. He hadn't been the only one firing. In the dead man's clothing, he found his wallet and entered a picture of the man's wife and child. For a moment, Ron felt the full humanity of the man, the horror of his death, the sorrow his family would know, but only for a moment. Then he had to shut those feelings down, deep down. Marines are not supposed to cry. And he would have to fight again. It would be years and many hours of therapy before Ron could confront his experiences, and it took writing a lot of poetry. When Ron went into high school classes, he read his poetry and the poetry of other veterans, and he talked about the war. One teacher asked her students to write their responses when the class met next, and she shared those with Ron. A young man wrote, "Thank you for helping me understand my father.
He fought in Vietnam, but he doesn't talk about the war. He doesn't talk much at all. Ron also coordinated the Alternatives to Militarism project. He wrote, designed, and distributed leaflets, showed films, and organized anti-war events. He had a chance to make a difference, and he used that chance, even though it meant reliving the dehumanization and the horror of his own experiences as a Marine. You whose names are on the wall died in Indochina, and so you never got a chance to mature and to make a difference as an adult member of society. Our country has never been enriched by all the talents you might have brought to us. Our society has never benefited from all the work you might have done. We've been deprived of your stories, your music, your smiles, your laughter, tears, and perhaps wisdom. Your loved ones never had a chance to watch you toss a ball back and forth with your children. Your children, those you left behind or those you never had, didn't have a chance to see you bounce your grandchildren on your knee. You likely would have had grandchildren by now. There is simply no way to measure the loss to your comrades in arms, to your friends, your family, and to all your fellow citizens. I wish I could believe that you died in a righteous cause. I do not. The only way we can bring meaning to your deaths is to remember you and to strengthen our resolve to work against war as an instrument of foreign policy. And truth to tell, there ought to be another wall, a wall bearing the names of those who came home from Vietnam but ultimately did not survive the war. That wall would need to contain an even greater number of names to include all those who committed suicide or who, because of drugs or alcohol or depression or reckless driving, died as a result of self-destruction. The name of my former brother-in-law, William Douglas Barnes, belongs on such a wall. A lighthearted young man before he went to war, he loved life and he loved good food. Billy would come to the front door of the family home in Connecticut and head directly to the kitchen to examine the contents of the refrigerator. After the war, Bill moved to Oregon with his second wife. He earned a master's degree at the University of Oregon, fathered a daughter, held a socially useful job, worked on his house. He coped. He was still genial and quick to laugh. But Bill didn't talk about Vietnam when we were together, except once. He was stoned. Then he talked about being blown out of his bunker. He talked about being abandoned in the jungle. He talked about Viet Cong nearby and how very near he did not know. When the helicopter came that came to evacuate them after a firefight could not lift off without leaving someone behind. In a way, he and so many other Vietnam veterans were abandoned. Again, when a government that had sent them to war learned all the wrong lessons from that war. America launched another war in another country, which we did not understand and in which the U.S. utterly lacked the potential to bring its people a decent future. The Iraq War put Billy and so many other veterans over the edge. He couldn't continue to cope. He couldn't keep it together. They said he died as a consequence of alcoholism. His family knows better. His family knows he died as a result of his military service. His sister speaks of the heartbreak of watching a loved one slowly suffer and dying from carrying the weight of the war daily. The only way we can bring meaning to the 60,000 or more delayed deaths is to remember those who perished after the war because they did not come home from Vietnam whole or in body or in spirit. And sooner or later, could no longer cope. They too should strengthen our resolve to work against war as an instrument of foreign policy. And finally, there are the people of Vietnam, of Laos, and Cambodia, who died in the millions in what they know as the American War. It took 20 years after the war ended on April 30th, 1975, for the U.S. to stop punishing Vietnam, to lift the embargo, to normalize relations. Now we wear cloth clothes with labels that say, Made in Vietnam. And Vietnam is a tourist destination, but people in Southeast Asia are dying from Agent Orange and from the mines and bombs the U.S. left behind. Some Americans have accepted responsibility for that, and they work to help clean up the mess our country left behind. Most of them are Vietnam veterans. I honored them. Marion Malcolm. Marion's first friend, Ron, died. You could probably guess that. He died of a heart attack, likely as a result of the trauma he carried from service in the military, from his drinking and whatever else he might have abused. So when we look at the results of the war of Vietnam, of the war of Iraq, Afghanistan, now Syria, Libya, and what's on the plate, what's coming, how can we help but acknowledge the futility? No wonder Memorial Day is what it is. Just a time to raise a flag, a burger, a beer, maybe go buy a car. But we don't really take the time. We don't really, as a public, take the effort to really sit down and understand Memorial Day and why we have a Memorial Day and whether Memorial Day is a good thing to have if we're just filling up Memorial Days with more names. As you know, veterans, 20 veterans, 20, 22 veterans commit suicide every day. 22 veterans commit suicide every day. And you, as you know, over a million citizens in Vietnam died because of us. And upwards of 100,000 have died in Iraq. And God only knows the number of deaths throughout the Middle East from our continued bombing, our drones. And we also need to understand and remember the number of people displaced. I heard on Democracy Now! Just this morning that I believe it was the Greek or the Italian Coast Guard is picking up people from a capsized boat, a number of which were children and a number of which drowned. No wonder most of the world considers us the terrorists. They're doing the math. And my heart goes out to the people in Manchester, and we're hearing the names of the children and of the parents that were there. Would it make a difference if we would hear the names and see the pictures of the children that we killed in Mosul within the last month, in Syria within the last month, who the kids in Yemen, who our weaponry have killed within the last month, and then take it back through the whole Obama administration and the Bush administration? How many
Would it make a difference if we could see the names and the pictures? No wonder they consider us terrorists. When will we ever learn? Well, Harvey and I asked Kathy Bennett, his wife, to read the last letter to the wall. After reading it over, she made Harvey and I leave the room. For this letter shows just how many lives are impacted by one life given to the military.
I don't know how to start this letter because I never gave you a specific nickname, and it feels inappropriate to call you by your first name. Most of the time, I just refer to you as my grandfather. I was told about this letter project today in one of my college classes, and I immediately wanted to write to you. I don't really know why. I know you won't answer me. Maybe it's because I feel like when I put these words down on paper, you might be able to see them, and you might know that I'm writing to you and thinking about you. There are things you should know, but mostly I have a lot of questions. You should know that Nanny, your wife Helen, stands up every Thanksgiving and thanks you for your sacrifice. Sometimes she cries. Everyone is always trying to hold in their tears anyway. 52 years have passed since you died, but you haven't been forgotten. I grew up knowing about you and learning about you. I've been told about all the brave and unusual things that you did. The gong that was given to Nanny in memory of you hangs up in our living room. It's been in the background of every prom and family picture. I guess that means that you've been in the pictures too, in a way. Your children have been interested in you, especially Mom. She found William Edge, and she talked to him for a few years before he died. After the war, he was a pastor somewhere out west. Isn't it crazy that time brought this man to you, and then when you saved him, you gave him time so that he could be brought to us? We have pictures that you had from Vietnam and Cambodia. You riding an elephant and holding an enormous snake. Did you ever imagine that the pictures you took would be the only way that your grandchildren would see you alive? I've read some letters you sent to Nanny, the monkey who lived with you, and how you shot off its tail. I've asked her about the time she spent in Okinawa. Her body might be failing, but her brain still remembers. Did you ever think that someday your memories and stories would be the only way that your children and grandchildren would know you? I think you would be proud of your family for carrying on your story. I know that they are proud of you. I'm proud of you. Sometimes I find myself wondering what life would have been like if you hadn't died in Cambodia. Would Uncle Bob have spent all that time in prison? Would Uncle Steve be able to keep a job or a wife? Would Uncle Andy still self-medicate? How would Aunt Kathy be different if she had ever had the chance to meet you? How would my mom be different if she wasn't constantly trying to piece together a father she can't remember? Would I even be alive today if you had lived? Would you have taught your grandsons to love the outdoors, fishing and hunting like you did? Would you have come to our football, field hockey, and soccer games? Would you have sat me on your lap and read me stories? Would you look like the picture that's on my wall since I can remember? Would you smell like aftershave or soap? What would your voice sound like when you told me that you loved me? I wonder if you thought that it was worth it in the end. Did you wholeheartedly believe in your mission and purpose for being there? Did you regret being there in your last moments? Did you regret anything in your last moments? I wonder what your last thoughts were. Did you think about your mom and dad, your wife, your four small children, your unborn baby? Was there anything that you wanted to say? Was there anyone there to say it to? Could you have spoken with a bullet in your neck? Did the person who killed you see your face? Did they even think for a second before they pulled the trigger about the hole they would be blasting through the lives of the people that you knew and loved? Could they have fathomed that your death would shatter a family for two generations? Did you ever think about that? I know it wasn't your intention to end up on a wall. I don't think it was anyone's intention. My mom always says that there's a reason for everything. I think there's some things that you can't find reasons for. Love, your granddaughter, Lindsay.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 8:59, and you've just been listening to Veterans for Peace Radio, Remembers China Grove, and Letters to the Wall. Coming up next, the Olmo Variety Hour, followed by Air Cascadia at 10, Locus Focus at 10:15 with Barbara Bernstein. She speaks to Steve Early, author of Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City. At 11, Intersections Radio welcomes to the KBOO studio Million Blues guitarist V.A. Farka Toure. And at 11:30, Between the Lines Radio reports on mounting evidence of Trump's obstruction of the Russian probe, plus North American indigenous divestment campaigns targeting pipeline funding banks. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not one, please become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. This is KBOO. It's 8:59. Happy Memorial Day.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Spring Motorcycle Swap Meet, Sunday, June 11th, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Milwaukee Elks Lodge in Oak Grove. The Spring Motorcycle Swap Meet is hosted by Abate of Oregon, a group that promotes motorcycle awareness, education, safety, and liberty through community involvement and legislative action. Again, that's the Spring Motorcycle Swap Meet, hosted by Abate of Oregon, on Sunday, June 11th, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. The outdoor swap meet is at the Milwaukee Elks Lodge, 13122 Southeast McLaughlin Boulevard in Oak Grove. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Vanport Mosaic Festival, May 26th through the 29th, at various locations throughout North and Northeast Portland. The second annual Vanport Mosaic Festival will offer an exploration of the history and legacy of Vanport through a series of films and plays, lectures and conversations, and guided tours. Audiences will be invited to reflect upon the journeys of those who lived and died in the city of Vanport.